trying to point out the non-thinking mind, the empty mind. Of course, this is a subtlety that most people, they don't see its value. I mean, people think that thinking is of great value, and to think your way to enlightenment is possible. That's why emptiness and non-self, they don't seem like anything, because they're not no thing at all. It's not a thing. But you can realize that which is no thing. It's a silence, it has the quality of silence or of space, emptiness. And you think, like, space here, it's like nothing, isn't it? It's in this room, just this space here. We contain, you know, we build walls and put up a building, so we have a sense of a spacious room. But it's really the room that we're looking at and the things in the room that we value. And the space itself, which is with us all the time and which we can't live without, we don't give any attention, we don't appreciate. So like in meditation, you're turning to that, recognizing, realizing that which is, it's always here. Whether you're here or there, there's always space. And there's always silence of the mind. There's always to recognize that silence, the background, the place where words and thoughts arise from, that is to really begin to penetrate the Dhamma, to really see the Dhamma, realize the Dhamma. And then, you know, if you just learn that much on this retreat, even if you had one moment of that kind of realization, that is probably better than most people will ever have. Most people are caught up in their thoughts and views. And they're looking for things, they're looking for something. You don't have to look, is it? The space in this room, you don't have to look for it. Just pay attention to it. Where's the space in this room? Spent the whole retreat trying to find it. We haven't seen it. Some of you expecting enlightenment to be like a kind of extraordinary kind of bombardment of light, or kind of totally zapped by a thunderbolt, I'm sure. You're waiting for Zeus to come along and kind of throw his thunderbolt at you. I'm enlightened. Like being electrified. But contemplate, I mean, enlightenment isn't. I mean, we can get those, we can get hits off of life, off drugs and things like that. Get touch an electric socket or something like that. You can get hits off meditation too. You can get high as a kite. You can get in, you know, just get into these blissful states of just like that. And I remember going to a Hindu ashram in India years ago, and 20 years ago, and I was, and everybody was into bhajans and bhakti practices, bhakti yoga, and I remember people walking around like this. Beautiful young girls in orange saris. Exactly. And I thought, this is very impressive, because in a Buddhist monastery, people don't look like that. What are we doing wrong in the Buddhist monastery? And then they told me that it collapsed as soon as they left the ashram. They were all afraid to leave the ashram and go to Bombay because that would just completely collapse, and they didn't know how to cope with Bombay and ordinary things. And you could, you know, they did love getting this high state, and they were kind of floating around like almost, you know, like they weren't with life, but they were just kind of in a state of hype. So then I contemplate in the Buddhist practice of it's very grounding, touching earth. It's with the body. We're not just trying to get into a high mental state that where we kind of just reject the world and the body and the planet, and we no longer can do anything, where we're completely useless because we aren't with life. We're attached to maybe a high state of conscious experience. So in the middle way, the Buddha used words middle way, Majjhima Patibhaka, quite significant. It's not just kind of a mediocre compromising with life. It's not that. It's not what most people think the middle way is. I think it's just making endless compromises and doesn't where the extremities are seem more attractive and more interesting, more exciting. But the middle way really is. It's just transcendent in a way that you're not transcendent doesn't mean getting out of, but it means seeing things, seeing in the right way, the mental objects. So that's why in when we take refuge in the Buddha, we take refuge in that attentive state, in awareness. Paying attention, these are the key words. Looking into, paying attention, being awake. What Buddha's teachings are all about, being awake, paying attention, watching, listening. What do we expect him to do it? Well, this is something we can all do, isn't it? We can all awake. It's just you do it. You don't practice something to get awake in the future. You just awake in the present. It's what you do right now and pay attention. And then you're looking at, you're paying attention to the way things are. You're not trying to say things should be other than this. We're not going to criticize or compare the one thing with another. We're paying attention on the level of just attentiveness. It's not to get hold of anything or to make any, you know, to manipulate or change things, but to just recognize the way it is. That kind of attentiveness is sustainable. And of course, one of the closest thing to us is the mood of the body and the mood of the mind. So you know, it's right here, and the mood you're in, the mental state you're in right now. It's just this way. And so, like foundations of mindfulness, they're paying attention to the way it is of the body, the feelings, the mental states, the Dhamma. So that's an ongoing practice. It's not dependent upon meditation retreats or monasteries or anything. It's just the way it is, wherever you know, when wherever you are, it's this way. And so the refuge is in this sustain, learning to trust and rest in this state of attention. Not attention in the sense of a forced concentration on something, but this receptive state of listening, watching. It's a relaxed state. It's not like you're trying to, you know, when you're concentrating, then you have to put more effort into it and concentrate on something. But just in the awakened state, it's more like a balanced state of mind. So it's not like having to force your mind onto something. It's just learning to develop, to cultivate this way of attention, of tension, listening, watching, awakened, and then investigating, mean looking at the roots and the causes and conditions of things, isn't making it into any kind of difficult task, but it's contemplating on the arising and ceasing the of conditions. So as you rest in the space or in that awakened state, then your reflective mind you can use your intelligence to contemplate things in terms of Dhamma, Tamanu, Pasana, Saripatthana, which is seeing things in according to the laws of nature rather than according to one's own biases or character or habitual tendencies. So that's why in this retreat we're going to encourage this in the silence and space and try not to make that into something you have to do, but something you begin to really appreciate and trust in just that much, you know, in something that you can develop, not something you're trying to make it into a big thing for this retreat, but just to learn how to feel more trusting and relaxed in that state of awareness, being aware. Because then that gives you tremendous ability to live your life in a way that you're learning from it, you're attentive to it, and you're not just helplessly caught in reacting to life. But if you don't know this, then you're just caught in reactions to things. You just can't help it. One is just a victim of one's emotional habits and circumstances. So you're going up and down with the praise and blame, successes and failures of worldly life. Liking this, not liking that. Wanting, not wanting, and you're just stuck there. If you're caught in the conditioned mind, if you're trying to think your way out of, think way to enlightenment, all you end up with is despair. I always feel you're never enlightened. The avicca bhajaya sankhara, sankhara bhajaya vijnanang. You know the story. And at the end of it, the soka parite wa sukha tomanasu payasa. So that's something that's from the point of a self trying to find something, trying to become something, trying to get rid of something. Me trying to meditate even. Me trying to not be anybody. Me trying to do whatever is the vichā, vajra, sankhara, and then there's always a sense of despair at the end of it. Well, that's why even after years of practice, you can feel despair, because if you haven't penetrated that reality ever, then I mean, just sitting on cushions and going to meditation retreats, developing a vichā, bhajya, sankhara, you still not for the same result. Maybe you develop bharami, you can sit longer or something like that, more patient. But you're not getting to the real practice, the real dhamma. But this is where the Buddha's teaching is so, you know, he says, when he was on his deathbed, he says, I leave you the Dhamma Vinaya. When Nanda is saying, who's going to be our teacher when you die? And I leave you, this is the Dhamma Vinaya. So the Dhamma is our, Vinaya is what helps us to live together. We're living in a way that is harmless and moral and respectful. So Vinaya is fulfilled that on a basic level, just communal relationships is to be harmless, not to intentionally harm each other, and to be morally responsible for action and speech, to try to support each other in the practice of Dhamma. And then in the Dhamma is the teaching, okay, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. And then, so that's a very direct teaching. It's not something that applies to something in the future. It's right now. It's uccupatipanno. It's immediate, apparent here and now. This Dhamma teaching is something that he gave us the right to use. This is this is something we can use. He says it's a teaching for human beings. So they're trying to put it in a context where we feel to confirm that it's something that you can do. It's something you have the right to do. Something you have the ability to do, rather than seeing it as something maybe, you know. That maybe, I mean, because one could easily put Dhamma in such a category that you can't do it, because things get raised up or get a kind of apotheosis, and I mean, I've seen this. I mean, people in the Buddhist world will kind of raise Dhamma up into such a high state that nobody's willing to do it. Or even the Four Noble Truths, they'll say, you know, people just can't realize those truths anymore. But this is not true. And as long as we have that feeling that the self-view is judging from my own experience, the self-view is always, it tends to make you doubt all the time. So as long as the self-view is the kind of the underlying cause of your practice, and it's never been really, really penetrated, never seen through, then you're always feeling a sense of kind of disappointment or despair in regards to practice. Because even your practice has this is still being interpreted from the self. And then, and I think that the Buddha's confirmation of, you know, the Dhamma Vinaya to Ananda, that's like a historical, whether it's true or not, I don't know. Maybe it never happened, but that's in the scriptures anyway. But it's a statement to me. It gives me a confidence in the fact that he was, the Lord Buddha was, you know, pointing to the fact that this is for you. It's not just Ananda, but it's for me and you. And this Dhamma teaching isn't something that is. For an age or something, you know, for say ancient India or pre-industrial third world countries or things like that, because you know, it's a timeless teaching. It's about the way things are. It's not about an age or a time, or it's not temporal, based on a sense of time. Even though in the tradition they do have that this is the teaching for this age, and then the next Buddha age will be the Maitreya Buddha, and so forth. And that is, you know, that's also subject to doubt and unsurety, because you know, those are you know, kind of interesting concepts. And in terms of what we can know now, say we can know suffering, we can know the causes, we can know the cessation, we can know the path. Because you are recognizing timelessness, akalika namma, in that. And so then the particular age isn't important. And in various interpretations, I mean, there are different ways of saying, you know, like Mahayana says that there were advanced teachings afterward or whatever. But, and I don't question that. But the advanced teachings that they often talk about are the Four Noble Truths. Just it's not that you don't find them really like the advanced teachings of Mahayana in any way kind of saying anything other than what you can find within the Four Noble Truths. The whole point of the thing is that once you break through the delusion, then the rest is. You know, what else is there to do but to serve others? And I mean, the Mahayana make the arahant sound like a totally selfish goal, and that you're just aimed towards self-enlightenment, and then the heck with the rest of you. But that's not how it works. You know, if you let go of the self, then you feel very much a part of everything. You know, the sense of oneness with all being, that's very much within the Theravada. And whether these ideas of taking on rebirth, those could, you know, but if that's coming from the egotistical view of self, then I don't trust it. But if that's an altruistic that's a realization that there is through letting go of the ego, then that's very beautiful. But what I don't trust is anything coming out of my egotistical views, no matter how altruistic they might be, because I don't trust that whole programming that's based on avijja. But if you get rid of avijja, then the kind of, you know, there's still, you know, one can, there's still, there's compassion, there's love, there's ways of there's just natural responses to life. If there's no self, then there's nothing to stop loving or compassion for the suffering of others. And how you want to make something out of that in terms of philosophical statements. But I don't, I mean, I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding just on the level of because people don't practice and realize the Four Noble Truths, then you do get maybe these ideas that arahants are just selfish people that have liberated themselves but could care less about everyone else. All I'm trying to do here is, I'm not trying to make a case for Theravada at all, but just to point to a way of meditating in which the problem is solved. You know, the sense of me and mine and the discriminative mind is seen in a perspective, and you're no longer operating from views about anything. You know, you're not coming from being Theravada anymore, from being Mahayana or any position. You're not taking a position, even on the Four Noble Truths. These aren't positions I'm taking, but they're just it's a convention to break through the delusion of the self being the identification of the five khandhas.